we begin the hour like we do each Tuesday by welcoming in our friend, writer, and critic, Colin Fleming. Hello there, Colin.
What up, Kimball?
I'm living the dream, my friend, doing what we do here on a rainy Tuesday. No Red Sox. What are you going to do tonight without the Sox? Crank out about 10,000 words, probably.
Yeah, gear up to crank out 10,000 words. I've been faltering lately, but yeah, I guess the game was canceled.
Yeah, postponed tonight.
Win 107 will have to wait.
Indeed. Doubleheader tomorrow with the powerhouse Baltimore Orioles. But today, we're not talking baseball. We're talking about fiction, and particularly YA fiction, young adult fiction, in your piece in the Daily Beast entitled Why Great YA Fiction Can Kick Adult Literary Fiction's Ass. Tell us more.
Have you read this particular book that piece was about, which would be John Belair's The House of the Clock and Its Walls?
I have not, and we were talking about the movie yesterday, but I understand you think the book is much better than the film.
I haven't seen the film yet, but just going by the trailer, it looks kind of like, you remember that Disney movie with the Haunted Mansion, and it was just like CGI, blue screen, and this kind of looks like an even worse version of that. Like the main character of this book, the young kid Lewis, in the novel he's like this chubby sort of kid, and that's a problem for him socially. And just, you know, the trailer came on during a Red Sox game, I looked up and I said, oh, they've made him all svelte, and of course they've Hollywooded it up. But the novel is quite wonderful, really, where it's purportedly about a house that sort of has this clock in the walls that could trigger the end of all time, or at the very least, Judgment Day, where the living will all die and the dead will come back to life. And it's kind of like the logistics of, if you read Frankenstein, and at the beginning, Mary Shelley's like, well, they discovered the secret to bring back life. She doesn't say what that is or theorize what that is, because of course she didn't know. So in this novel, you don't really understand quite what the clock's role is exactly, but you know it's really important. It was put there by the person who used to occupy this house, and this young boy has come to live in it now with his uncle Jonathan after the boy's parents were killed in a car accident. And it is highly, highly imaginative, and that's, I guess, what I'm saying is the difference here with young adult fiction. You have to entertain these children with what you write. The onus is on you, because no kid is going to pretend to like something that they absolutely cannot stand to read, which is basically the entire converse of how literary fiction right now works.
So you're saying there perhaps is less pretentiousness, that kids aren't going to say, I love this book, because they think they're supposed to?
Something like literary fiction, I don't think that there are many people on planet Earth who honestly enjoy reading some of the things that we've sort of referenced on this program, or he worked to liberate her breast from the restraining order imposed by a particularly officious brassiere. That's not me being clever in the moment and making up a hyperbolic example. That's actually from a story that has just seared into my brain because it's so bad and that's so typical. And I think what happens is, the notion, the very label of literary fiction means, you're not a badge holder here. You do not belong to this island of rarefied people. I am so smart. I like this thing and understand this thing that no one else likes or understands. It's an island of misfit toys type of thing. And if you think about the term literary fiction, would you have ever described Charles Dickens as being a writer of literary fiction? Or Mark Twain?
No.
F. Scott Fitzgerald? Or Sheridan Le Fanu, or whomever you want to name from the past, would you ever describe them Flaubert? No. They were just really good writers who wrote work that was highly accessible and that someone could also study 800 years off in the future. And that's not what's happening. You have this island of misfit toys, what a friend of mine terms less charitably a subculture of freaks, writing things that no one else back on the mainland wants to read. And whereas with young adult fiction, you are tasked as a writer with entertaining, and your imagination can go as far as your imagination can go. That is, as far as you're able to take it. And that's something that's not really encouraged in the literary fiction world.
And you talk about it in your piece in the Daily Beast. And we've talked about it here, too. A big factor is the honesty of children. But that also means that there has to be a level of honesty when you're writing for them as well. Because they'll see through the nonsense.
True. Kids will. Kids will call BS on you awfully fast. And the notion of, oh, I'm just going to pretend to like this, it puts me in a club, is something that kids, when they've had, like, you know, their dinner and they've watched some TV and they're going off to bed and they're trying to read in bed, they're not doing it to, like, take a selfie with some, like, different edition of Infinite Jest to be like, ha-ha, look how smart I am on the Facebook. No, they just want to stay up as late as they can reading something that compels them. And you're no good as a writer if you can't compel people. In fact, how good you are as a writer is in proportion to how much you compel people to actually like your work, to get something out of it, to be entertained. It doesn't mean you're giving someone just something happy and hunky-dory, because you can entertain someone when you are tearing their heart apart, really, with a work of art. And so what we have with the house with the clock in its walls is this story about locating, really, this clock. But what it really comes down to more than anything is this boy's struggle to fit in. So you can have, out in the world, all of the plot points you want. You can have dragons, you can have closets that lead to Narnia, whatever else is going on. But really what is transpiring that's most important is going to be happening within a character, within their mind, within their heart, in the purview of their feelings. And so this boy, Lewis, he actually attempts and succeeds in raising the dead at a cemetery simply because he is scared that he will lose the only friend he has managed to make in this new town. And what is a better metaphor, a better microcosm for how we feel as kids? Any kid's going to connect with that. You're not going to connect with the fact that your house has a pulse and this clock is about to trigger the end of the world and what are you going to do? Oh, my. You're going to connect with being that lonely at some point or other, whether you are that kid who has newly moved to town and thinks you can't fit in, or whether you're that kid who's looked at as being super cool and doesn't really enjoy that because you think maybe people don't like you for the right reason.
We're talking with Colin Fleming. You also mentioned that perhaps there should be a third category of fiction for adults, and one that's not genre, one that's also not literary fiction. What would it be?
There needs to be a third category, exactly. We've discussed some of the things, some of the stories that I've written on this show, and I always think of them as belonging right now to their own category, sadly, and I don't feel like they ought to. I try to inspire people through what I write and what I say and how outspoken I can be about how literary fiction is killing off the act of reading, to come along with me to write things that are not genre. We know what we're getting with genre. It's often mailed in. You're getting just a trope fest. All those tropes are going down your throat, and you know exactly where the little beats are going to come, and that's part of the reading experience. It's just the inevitability of so many things. You have that for fiction, and then you have literary fiction, which has to invent this title to bestow this kind of honorific of, ooh, aren't we so important on it? You need the third category, where something is every bit as inclusive as genre writing, and yet is something that can be artful. So it's written to layers. It's written for that person who thinks they're getting it completely, and maybe there aren't things that they aren't getting at all, and they're going completely over their head, but they're not aware of it. Or it's also written for that professor who's going to study it and write a book about it later. And it's also written for the 17-year-old who's just some horny kid who's goofing around with his pals. It has to hit on all the levels, and that's what the people we were talking about, a Dickens, a Twain, they're not shirking on the literary quality, the artful quality of something like Huck Finn or A Christmas Carol. You look at something like A Christmas Carol, note the prose this winter when you read it around Christmas time. Note how singularly artful it is. Note the voice of it. It's indelible. You never forget it once you hear, like, or read a single clause. It lodges in the mind. So I'm for that third category. Like, why can't we do both? Why can't we include people and be artful. Let's move people. And the reason why people in literary fiction don't want that third category is most people in literary fiction have no ability whatsoever. They just have want to, as I put it. That maybe that's what their parents did, and they were supposed to get these good grades, and they became these drones who went to Yale and then Iowa for an MFA. There was never any compunction to entertain people. It's just worshiping their own navels and writing stories about their MFA programs, and no one on planet Earth save the people in those systems who pretend to like it actually likes it.
And that third category would have to be based, I would assume, on honesty and on real people, not the stock characters that populate some of these other works.
Right. Honesty is something that I can read something from somebody, it can be a clause, and it's like sodium pentothal. I can tell right away if they're full of it or if they're not, if they're just interacting even in an email. But it's the level of language in a book. And honesty doesn't mean that it's social realism. You can have an honest story about a basset hound who talks to a dragon, but it has to come from a place where that is really how that basset hound is. You have to feel that talking basset hound who befriends the dragon is out there in the world, or could be, that he or she encapsulates a set of real feelings, because it is into those feelings which you plug your own feelings, and you flip a switch, and the switch goes on. That's what honesty is. When I flip the switch, when I plug in with this other stuff, I'm just getting, like, dead air. There is nothing there. There's no light coming on in my room. You have to have it so the switch flips, and there's that connection. And that's the form of honesty that marks. Go and think of anything you've ever read that'll last or that moved you, that marks all of that, every single last piece, book, poem, play, novel, novella, what have you.
Do yourself a favor and go check out, if you haven't read it already, or go back and reread John Belair's The House with the Clock in Its Walls. And, of course, go to ColinFlemingLit.com for all of Colin's latest work as well. Thank you, my friend. We'll do it again next Tuesday.
Sounds good.
Colin Fleming, every week here on Downtown.